Chapter 30. Awake, thou that sleepest. It will be indeed sweet at its first taste when it heals you. But murmur not over truth if you find its digestion bitter. Mary Baker Eddy. It was about 1902 when a Chicago physician, Dr. Edmund F. Burton, who had been using morphine for nearly a year to subdue the symptoms of consumption, was advised by two of his colleagues that his only chance for life was to move to Arizona. Dr. Burton wrote, "When I went to Arizona, I tried to stop the drug, but found that I had a well-founded opium habit, and that when I attempted to break it, which I did several times, the lung trouble became too serious to be borne. Thus, the habit increased, as it always does. I had been a moderate drinker, but became less moderate in the use of alcohol, and soon began to use cocaine to alleviate both the effects of the morphine and for throat symptoms. To make a long and miserable story as short as possible, these three things, alcohol, morphine, and cocaine, became my food and drink. After some time in Arizona, I went to Southern California, to Pasadena. Here, I sought the aid of a hypnotist to enable me to free myself from these habits, and found this method ineffectual. After this experience, the quantity of the three things that I was taking was enormously increased, until toward the end, I was taking such quantities of morphine and cocaine as no one has ever recovered from, so far as I know. I became entirely demented and a menace to those about me." In the spring of 1905, when Dr. Burton had been unconscious for 48 hours, five of his fellow physicians held consultation and told Mrs. Burton he could not live 3 or 4 weeks and arranged that he be sent to the state asylum the next day. On this dark day, April 19, 1905, a friend induced Mrs. Burton to allow a Christian Science practitioner to call, which he did, spending 3 hours with her husband. Dr. Burton says, "I have no memory of his coming or of his going, but he left me asleep, and I woke on the following morning free from all these habits, normal in brain and nerves, hungry, energetic, clear-headed, and happy. I knew the moment that I awoke that something had happened to me, and that whatever had done it, I was free from the awful things that had bound me. But I did not know what it was that had done it until I was told. From that moment, I have never felt the slightest appetite for an opiate, cocaine, or alcohol in any form, have never felt any symptoms of lung trouble, and have been mentally sound and clear. Nor was there a moment of convalescence. My bowel condition was normal. My nerves were steady and quiet. I read quietly and with understanding for the greater part of the morning, a book which took a great deal of mental concentration to understand, the like of which I had not been able to do for months. I drove my automobile half the afternoon, also a thing I had not been able to do for some time." April 20th, 1905 was a great turning point in Dr. Burton's life. A year later, at 5:13 a.m. on Wednesday morning, April 18th, 1906, a severe earthquake rocked California, causing San Francisco to suffer one of the worst disasters in United States history. Overturned stoves and gas lamps, plus broken electric wires and gas mains, caused explosions and raging fires, which could not be checked because of broken water lines. For 3 days, the fires raged, and on the second day, Dr. Burton was asked to assist in the surgical work at the San Francisco Emergency Hospital. This was April 20th, exactly 1 year from the day of his miraculous recovery. He responded to the call for help, and for 3 weeks I stood on my feet and operated for about 16 hours a day. This was my last surgery, and coming after a year of study of Christian Science decided me as to my future course. As the news of the catastrophe spread across the country, earthquake relief funds sprang up. The following appeared in the Concord Patriot. Concord will do its full share in the work of relieving the suffering people of San Francisco. This was made evident last night at a meeting called by the Commercial Club to systematize the work of relief. At first, the idea was expressed that $2,000 would be about all that Concord could afford to give to the fund. But Mr. M. Meehan changed the aspect of affairs by presenting the following letter. April 23, 1906. Dear Sir, enclosed herewith is check for $1,000, my contribution to the local fund for the relief of the San Francisco sufferers. You will please turn the same over to the treasurer of the committee. Very truly, Mary Baker Eddy. Following the reading of Mrs. Eddy's letter, the local citizens determined to endeavor to raise $5,000 for the relief fund. About the same time the Concordians were meeting, a Christian Scientist in California was writing this letter, April 25, 1906. Dear Mrs. Eddy, I was instructed by the Board of Directors of First Church of Christ Scientist, San Jose, California, on the evening of the day of the earthquake, after we had held our regular Wednesday evening meeting, to wire you that none of the scientists in this community had received any bodily injury, and that our new church was practically untouched by the terrible disaster. But it has been impossible to send any satisfactory telegram, hence this letter. We were obliged to hold our service by candlelight, for all electric and gas lines were cut off. It would indeed have gladdened your heart to have heard the testimonies given that night, and to have listened to the grateful thanks offered to our loving Father for the precious gift to mankind of science and health, and its loved author, you, our dear leader, whereby peace, comfort, and assurance had been granted to each one to sustain him throughout the trying ordeal. On Sunday, no services were allowed in the city's limits, and in consequence, we held our service in a schoolroom outside the city. It will please you to know that telegrams offering assistance have been received from scientists in distant cities. We were glad to be able to say to all these loving offers that we did not need anything, and this, we understand, is equally true of our brethren in San Francisco, Oakland, and neighboring towns. A young businessman who has lately come into an understanding of Christian Science was buried for 3 hours under a mass of debris through the collapse of a hotel. His mouth and nose were almost stopped up with mortar, and his body was crushed into a seemingly impossible space. He told me that while confined in this position, he saw more clearly than ever before the truth taught by Christian Science, that the mortal concept of himself was not the real self at all, that the real self was ever free and was so right then. He was finally rescued, uninjured, and one of the physicians who was on hand to render any assistance possible told me that he could not understand how any, quote, living soul could have been rescued from such a place, end quote. Faithfully yours, Herbert W. Eustace. Dr. Burton's surgical work for 3 weeks following the earthquake and fire decided him as to his future career. He spent the ensuing year in the study of Christian Science and then began its practice. In January of 1915, Senator John D. Work of California used Dr. Burton's letter of testimony in the United States Senate in opposing a bill for a federal Department of Health. Dr. Burton's letter said, "I was most enthusiastic in the practice of surgery and was a Pharisee of the Pharisees as to its virtues. I gave it up only after being most thoroughly convinced that there was something better. I have learned, to my entire satisfaction, knowing both sides of the question, that Christian Science is a science, and not only that, but also that it is an advanced step, and a long one, beyond medicine and surgery, and that time will prove this to the whole world." Following San Francisco's experience, earthquakes and disasters were on every tongue for weeks, and it was important that Christian Scientists reverse this trend. In mid-May, the leader sent these instructions to her board of directors. "Consider this my proposition, that you require some of the best Christian Scientists in Boston and vicinity to pray once each day that no thought of earthquake, tornado, or destructive lightning enter thought to harm it, but that he who reigns in the heavens and watches over the earth saves from all harm. Again, let me say, pray not on higher, but the demand of love to God and man." This proposition, no doubt, freed the thoughts of the directors to pursue the main item on their agenda at that time, which was the completion of the extension in the specified time. They had already announced in the April 14th Sentinel that it was to be dedicated on Communion Sunday, June 10th. In that same issue of the Sentinel, the leader had published a card, Miscellany, page 25, saying she would not be present in propria persona at the dedication. As the magnificent Mother Church was nearing completion, the leader knew only too well the dangers besetting the pathway of the students, and that popularity and pride would cause them to worship church edifices. Louis Strang did a splendid job of presenting the danger in a letter to the editor of the Sentinel on April 21st. This letter, Miscellany, page Roman numeral 5 to Roman numeral 7, was published in the Sentinel of April 28th under the title, quote, lest we forget, end quote. Perhaps the most significant paragraph reads, strive it ever so hard. The Church of Christ Scientist can never do for its leader what its leader has done for this church. But its members can so protect their own thoughts that they are not unwittingly made to deprive their leader of her rightful place as the revelator to this age of the immortal truths testified to by Jesus and the prophets. When the leader selected Mr. Strang's letter for the foreword in First Church of Christ Scientist and Miscellany, was she not reminding us once again not to let her great revelation be engulfed by and buried in the organization? Quote, Lord God of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget, end quote. Quote, lest we forget, end quote, and a letter from Mrs. Eddy, which had also appeared in the April 28th Sentinel, were both republished in the May Journal. The leader's letter to her board of directors, Miscellany, page 26, thanked them for, quote, the largest sum of money that I have ever received from my church, end quote. It also stated, the enclosed notice I submit to you, and trust that you will see, as I foresee, the need of it. Now is the time to throttle the lie that students worship me or that I claim their homage. Gratitude and appreciation, not homage, are the avenues for understanding both Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science. The notice, Miscellany, page 27, she sent for publication, read, to the beloved members of my church, the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, divine love bids me to say, assemble not at the residence of your pastor emeritus at or about the time of our annual meeting and communion service, for the divine and not the human should engage our attention at this sacred season of prayer and praise. In April, the leader invited Mr. Carpenter to return to Pleasant View with his wife for a visit. On the morning of April 27th, Mrs. Eddy opened her Bible at random, as was her custom, and gave them a lesson on the passage God gave her. That morning, she opened to Luke 9, verse 56. Quote, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. End quote. Mrs. Carpenter wrote down the leader's words as she recalled them on the train on their way home. What is the Son of Man? He is the idea of God, the consciousness of truth. If you had children, you would make them obey. You would find some way to make them mind. And if you couldn't do it any other way, you would punish them. If you wanted to get a man out of a house, would you make it comfortable for him? No, you would make it uncomfortable. You would pull down the chimneys and take out the windows. Now we have got to get out of this house, mortal habitation. What holds us in it? Pleasure or pain? The pleasures of sense hold us, not the pains of sense. I've got to get out of this old woman, and you, Mrs. Carpenter, have got to get out of this young woman. Is this mortal existence real? No. Is there any mortal man? No. It is only the Adam dream. Is it real then? No. Then is there any pain? No. Then we are out of it. now? Is there any creation apart from God? No. Then is he the father of children? No. Can he be the father of a lie? No. Has a lie a father? No. Then is there any lie? The daughter of man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. All her words were to waken them from the Adam dream, the belief in a material creation, to see the reality of spiritual being here and now. All wanted to be healed of pain, of human disease and discord, but none wanted to be healed of pleasure, of human ease and harmony. Hence the leader's thankless task. But some in her home were elevated into more spiritual latitudes, as can be seen in Mr. Carpenter's words. Many of the students did not relish having their human harmony invaded and shaken up, and they rebelled as much as they dared. Others were obedient and thoughtful and yielded to the greater wisdom of their leader. They were the ones in whom she was able to accomplish the healing of human harmony, so that they gained a taste of divine harmony, and who would willingly go back to the deadening condition of the false peace of mesmerism after they had been touched by and experienced the soul-satisfying divine harmony, which Mrs. Eddy's rebuking and healing of human harmony brought out in them. About the time of the Carpenter's visit, Calvin Fry received a letter inquiring, "Has Mrs. Eddy given out any orders recently or at any time that Christian Science practitioners are not to take Roman Catholic patients or give them any of her writings?" I doubt the truth of any such report, as it is not consistent with Christian Science teaching, but for the satisfaction of others, I think it is my duty to inquire at headquarters about the matter. This letter, together with Mr. Fry's answer of May 4th, was published in the Sentinel under the title, quote, "A Question Answered," end quote. In reply to your question, quote, "Has Mrs. Eddy given out any order recently or at any time that Christian Science practitioners are not to take Roman Catholic patients or give them any of her writings?" We'll say, Mrs. Eddy has issued no such orders. She takes no patients, but through her writings gladly helps all those who will receive her help. This may have elicited protests from representatives of the Roman Catholic Church, because a bylaw amendment was published before the end of June which said, "Neither the pastor emeritus of the Mother Church nor Christian Scientists shall treat or teach Roman Catholics except with the written consent of the authorities of their church. Teaching and healing are separate departments. If you cannot heal without teaching said patients, abstain from doing either." Less than a month after the publication of this amendment, Mind clarified the issue for all time, and Mrs. Eddy changed the bylaw to the present reading in the manual, page 87, Article 27, Section 4. A Sunday school superintendent in Indiana wrote an appreciative letter to the leader on May 10th, describing their work in Indianapolis. One paragraph of her letter stated, "Once, when the chapter for study was Matthew 2, A young mother said, quote, "My child has never heard the word death. So I did not read about Herod's killing of the children." End quote. It seemed to me to attempt such a course was impracticable and really suggested by fear, that instead the child needed the protection of the spiritual explanation. This brought forth from the leader's pen, quote, "inconsistency," end quote, Miscellany, page 235, in which she states the impossibility of teaching the truth of life without using the word death. She asks the gentle, devoted mother, quote, "Can I teach my child the correct numeration of numbers and never name a cipher?" End quote. Milk for babes and meat for men. Eugene H. Green was soon to teach the Board of Education class in the Metaphysical College, and Mrs. Eddy wrote him on May 31st. "One thing I forgot to name is this. Teach your class that the pleasures of sense material are to be overcome as well as its pains. Hence the scripture, quote, none but the pure in heart can see God," end quote. The sexual element is not natural. If nature is God, and it certainly is God, for matter is not God, and material sense has no law and no gospel on its side. Even eating is a suffer it to be so now. Sometime we shall all learn this. Let us begin now to learn it and to practice it.